The Production Expert Podcast is brought to you with the kind support of Arturia, Avid, Source Elements, and RSBE Audio Solutions.
Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast. I'm Julian Rogers, and in this week's edition, I'm joined by Cher and George Tizard and Rick Parkhouse of Super High. We're going to be talking about the creative vision and technical making behind a chart hit. I'm gonna hand over to Cher because you know these guys, so please introduce us and set it up.
I mean, I worked with Rick and George about 10 years ago now in their wonderful studio in Bournemouth. But yeah, Rick and George, you've obviously been working as a duo in this industry for a long time, not only as Super High, but also with other very well established artists. So could you sort of briefly tell us about how you both started out, some of the artists you work with, and how the duo kind of became a thing?
We met in a studio when I was about 16, so a long, long time ago. Rick was playing session guitar on an EP when I thought I was a real artist. fast forward about 5 years and we were both about to quit music because we'd both sort of had enough of the knockbacks and the disappointments. And we met, I was after some free mixes and Rick's an amazing mix engineer. Mm-hmm. And Rick was sort of looking for maybe a property to start a studio. My family are in properties, so we met for a drink, got absolutely, can I swear, we got shit faced. and by the end of it we were in business together, and then that was all where it stemmed from. We've been together for 12 years and never had an argument.
Happy days.
That is incredible. How do you do that, not have arguments?
Have enough of them at home.
Yeah. Oh, no, really? I actually think it's because more often than not we're on the same page, and when we're not, it makes us question our own thought process, if you know what I mean. So if George is like, no, I really don't like that, I'm like, well, hang on a second, he might have a point here. Yeah. And I think that's how it sorts itself out.
Gosh, I think you should be giving advice to all of us, to be honest, for that.
I think creatively as well, we've always just been very much of the mindset that the best idea wins. And so it doesn't really matter whose idea is, how many you've had in a row. The best idea always has to win.
So your egos aren't sort of colliding then, clearly?
Yeah, that's it. You've got to keep ego out of it to a large degree, particularly when you're working with artists, because that's their job. They have the ego, and our job is to help them articulate their vision. So making sure that you don't change things just because you want to change it, or you want to feel like you've done something or contributed, is very important. It's kind of like I surf, so I always liken it to surfing. You ride the wave you're given, and you don't try to do things that the wave won't allow. You have to just go with the flow.
Do you think it's because you sort of both complement each other in terms of skill set? I know there's some overlap as well.
Definitely. Yeah. I think we do different things. We have quite different personalities. I feel like we're in therapy or something.
Well, can you nail those down then? Who does what? How does it divvy up?
Rick's probably more like the technical side. He's, I don't know, I'm just going to pay you loads of compliments. He's very meticulous, he likes to finish things, he's got a very high level of technical expertise, and I'm just a freeloader who sort of goes along and just latches onto his coattails.
Well, you're a very good instrumentalist, as far as I remember, George.
I can play everything badly, I do more lyrics, but yeah, we just sort of fill in the gaps, really. We fill in the gaps. And then I was going to say that when we work with a lot of artists who have an ego or need to feel like their ego is the most important in the room. So I think that naturally we both know how to just sit there and, make sure we're harnessing that, as opposed to really fighting it. And so that when it comes to just being on our own, we sort of have the same sort of outlook. So it kind of works.
Yeah, nice.
George is being very modest there. I think actually it's quite important I think one of the reasons that, if we've had any success, that one of the reasons that we have had is because I think George is a really good top liner, like lyricist and melody and all of that kind of stuff. He plays instruments as well, so he's got all that covered. But when people come to a production duo, they're not expecting any help with lyrics. They're expecting us that we're the track guys and we do this and that. And quite often, George basically just makes sure that that whole side of things really flows. And they sort of don't even realise what's happened. But before you know it, George has helped the whole process kind of along. And they don't feel threatened because it's not like, oh, there's a top liner in the room.
It's, there's that whole thing happening.
Yeah. So that's actually really important and definitely a kind of secret weapon, I think.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Because there aren't lots of producers that do kind of everything like you do, you know. I think that's pretty impressive. So when you start a new track, what's kind of your approach? Does it sort of depending on the vibe or the artist? Do you have like a particular process or is it sort of as it happens?
Yeah, I think we usually start with just a musical idea that gives us a good, both of us a good feeling. If it gives one of us a good feeling, that's not good. It has to give both of us a good feeling. And then from the you know, it could be the tiniest little thing, you know, just literally some chords on a synth or, you know, guitar chords, whatever. And from that point onwards, it kind of develops pretty organically, I'd say, into a song. You know, we don't really, even when we're preparing tracks, we're always thinking about lyrics and melody as well at the same time. Even if they all get binned in the end, we always kind of create music around some kind of idea melodically.
Mm-hmm. And does that kind of differ from, you know, if you've got a established artist with very clear ideas that come to you versus, you know, the stuff that you do as super high? I can imagine that will probably differ quite a lot.
Not. It depends what kind of session it is. We've just done some hip-hop sessions where it was very much, we had to come in with almost fully formed tracks. With some of the bigger artists, we'll have starts, you know, very, very, like, just sort of, I hate the word vibe, but vibes, we're just looking for someone to bite on something. And we've always got melodies and lyrics and concepts in the back of our minds, but certainly with most artists we won't put them forward unless we're stuck. And it's all about trying to get them into a flow, trying to bring them into the session and really get into it, and then at that point we're away.
Yeah, completely. I totally agree. But also I would say something that's really important is to do a bit of preparation, absolutely, but also prepare to start from fresh. Because sometimes you'll come into a room and the artist will be like, I really want to do pursue this particular idea. And you've prepared up-tempo tracks or whatever and they want to do a ballad. And if you can't force people to write a song they don't want to write.
Yeah, so you can't say I've made this beat or song starter.
No. So you need to do your preparation, and the preparation is always it's always useful in some way, shape or form, but also be flexible enough that if you need to, and also it's quite intimidating, I think, to just go back to, you know, blank canvas, but you know, just trust in being able to get there from nothing.
We had a session with quite a big artist in LA, and it was with another producer. We were in the producer's studio and we got on really well with the artist pre-session, and then the new producer turned up and he had a very set idea of the song he wanted to write, what he wanted it to be like, and we could tell that the artist wasn't enjoying it. We couldn't really say anything because we were in someone else's studio, so we couldn't mediate it as we wanted to. Funnily enough, we never got another session with that artist, so, and we're blaming the producer.
Really? So you were there as like songwriters then, or kind of co-producers?
Kind of a bit of both, like co-producers, co-writers, but with someone, it was definitely someone else's space, and we were visitors in that, so we couldn't control it. Whereas had that been in our studio, and which we've had it before, if we'd have seen it going that way and we'd have been in control of the session, we would have probably taken the producer to one side and gone, hey, look, we need to go with, I nearly said his name then, someone else's idea here, and then, you know, see where that leads us.
It's interesting that you say it can feel a bit intimidating to start from scratch, and it's good to hear you say that, because obviously there's both of you, you've both got, you know, every single technique kind of down, you know, and you still feel intimidated, perhaps, by...
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
I think it's... I think the moment you don't, you're probably, I don't know, probably something's going wrong. You know, there's something about that kind of adrenaline rush at the beginning of the day where you're like, crikey, we've really got to get something here, particularly in the bigger sessions. That's what gets you out of bed. That's what kind of, you know, that's the thrill of it. And then it makes it even better when you get on a good idea from that point. When you start playing someone, someone's like, oh, I love that. And the kind of excitement builds in the room and everybody's into it. And that's where you get the best stuff. But there is also, you know, there are those times when you kind of sit there blankly and things are not happening. And that's a horrible feeling. And that's why I think you get nervous for it, because you just don't want that feeling.
We've had
nasty.
We've had it more and more recently as we've got, I don't want to say luckier and more successful, that we get more time with the artist. But we've come from a point where we used to be given maximum a day with an artist, and if you didn't have something brilliant by the end of that day, that was it. You don't get another session. So the pressure on those sessions is so high, and if the artist comes in as a bad day, it's kind of all over kind of thing. So we're luckier now that we get a little bit more time, because it's all about, you know, if you spend a week with somebody and you there's no pressure, that's when you get the best ideas.
Well, exactly.
You have less and less of the fear.
Ever wondered what it's like to mix an entire album for Kanye or layering vocals for Chris Brown? Join your hosts Cash and G every fortnight as we sit down with some of your favourite artists, producers and engineers to talk everything music, brought to you by Avid Pro Tools.
That sounds great.
Yeah. It's not conducive to creativity to have so much pressure to, you know, create a hit. But what does that even look like, you know, when you've got something that's worthy of, you know, how does that look? Is it like
a good
sort of
idea?
Demo? Yeah. How, you know, what do they consider as you've got something good after a day of working?
Then everyone's bouncing around the room saying, actually, we always say when an artist starts talking about the video, and you're like,
yeah,
we're in.
That's the one, yeah. Because I can see the video for this.
Visualize
and
the
then you're
thing.
Like, yeah, that.
And crucially, before the label and management heard it and said it's shit.
That's true. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Is that only takes a couple of like negative opinions for you to completely change your opinion on a song?
So true.
Because it's so subjective. You know, no one really knows. And if you could be absolutely loving something, you send it off, and then someone goes, oh, does that really, it's all right. Then you're kind of like, oh.
It's same with us.
Maybe
though.
It's not very good.
Same with us. If I come up with something and you're like, yeah, it's okay. I'm like, yeah, you're right. It's so rubbish. I'm sorry. Apologize. Should have just shut up.
No, that's... But do you sort of mix it before you send it then, Rick?
Yeah, we try and always have... So back in the day, we worked with... can I say the name, do you reckon? They're probably... Yeah, and we worked with a band who was signed to Geffen Records, and we sat down with the A&R and they played us all the songs that were in contention. And it became really clear to us as we listened through, you know, 20, 25 tracks, the sort of difference in the standards of demos. Some people were like literally turning in basically kind of like voice notes, you know, here we go, this is the idea. And then the ones, there were some songs from America from like a really big gun producer, and they weren't necessarily the best songs, but by God, they sounded amazing. Mm. And the A&R was going, we're thinking this is the single. And we're sat there going, of course you're thinking it, because it sounds absolutely incredible. It sounds like you don't have to do any work. You can just put that on radio tomorrow and it goes. And ever since then, we've tried to take that approach to the point where we're actually quite awkward about sending out bounces, because
hate it.
We want to present it as close to what we think is finished as possible.
People get demo-itis on an idea, and then you know it's not like sonically correct, and it'll kill us. We also had a manager in America once who we sent he was an A&R for Universal and was managing us, and we sent him just a rough demo or something, and he called us and shouted us down the phone. He said, what the F is this? He said, you know, I can't hear through a demo. If it doesn't sound like it's already on the radio, I can't hear it. And that was like, okay.
That's an interesting one. That's two of my favourite examples of this, which are at completely different ends of the spectrum, are the story of Big George, who wrote the Have I Got News For You theme, who demoed it, pitched it in the office on acoustic guitar and kazoo. Which,
brilliant.
He did it for reasons. Basically, he didn't want to hand over a recording of it because he'd been stung before of
people nicking it.
Yeah. Surprisingly similar things happening when he hadn't got the job. But I heard a demo version of Toxic, like Britney Spears' Toxic, and Kathy Dennis, I think, wrote
it
that.
Was.
And it is the single, but with Kathy Dennis doing the vocal.
That's it.
I mean, it was completely sorted. And to be honest, I preferred it because it's like...
yeah, yeah. Well, but that's actually... You raise a really fair point there. Quite often we've had songs where people fall in love with the demo so much, they try it with an artist, and when the artist sings it, everybody's like, nah, it's lost something. And then, you know, the whole cut falls out of bed because the artist that they had in mind doesn't sound as good as the demo singer. So it's an interesting balance because obviously the demo singer's got to sell the track, but if they're too good or have got too much character, it's quite hard sometimes to live up to that vocal.
Yeah, sure. So you've got to keep in mind who you're pitching it for in terms of the performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
more definitely. And more now we've been having conversations with people about AI because it's getting to a point where if you wanted to pitch a track at Selena Gomez, you might be able to make it put Selena Gomez on it. And we, as the debate is, as a singer, I'm opening this up to the floor. Would you, as an artist, would you like to hear a pitched song that's already got you on it that you didn't sing?
Or would that
freak you out?
Personally, I think that would be cool because then you know exactly how it's, you know, pretty much how it's going to sound.
You'd be like, brilliant, I don't even need to sing it.
I think I'd feel incredibly threatened by that.
I think I would as well.
Just in terms of, there was a video I saw the other day somewhere on socials, I don't know, of a voiceover actress who was feeling very, very pleased about how easy it was to come in and do this stuff and get set up so that sign a piece of paper, hand over the rights to your likeness effectively for AI use. And so there's a lot of money for not very much work. And I was thinking, yeah, I think you're looking at this the wrong way around. There's a lot of, it's not very much money to sign away the amount of work you're now not going to get.
Yeah.
Because people don't need you anymore. So.
Yeah. So what are your general thoughts? I think I can hear what your general thoughts of AI are with production. Do you think it's going to sort of take our jobs?
We're talking about it a lot, aren't we? We're literally having so many conversations with people about this at the moment, and I still haven't nailed any colours to the master.
I think it would be foolish to predict that it wasn't going to play a huge part in what we do. Maybe not now, but it's moving so fast, and it's getting better at such a quick rate that I think that it would be crazy for people to dismiss it and say, it's nothing, never going to happen. You know, the stuff that we've heard so far, it's not really convincing enough to me anyway for me to be reaching for, you know, the wallet to buy the vocal emulator plugin or whatever. They all just sound a bit naff to me, but it won't be long before they don't.
Yeah,
we got shown this thing the other day on, what was it, on Discord, where you type in if you've got a vision for an image in your head, you literally type it into the computer and then it comes back. It takes a little while, but it creates a photorealistic image, and you can even choose the type of lens that it's shot on and all this kind of stuff, and it's unbelievably good.
Isn't it similar to sort of is it DALL-E, that kind of thing?
I forget what it was called, but it blew my mind.
Great for artwork.
Yeah,
it does sound very similar. What I'd suggest in that is I agree with what you're saying, but one thing I know about kind of like, you know, 21st century culture is that there isn't one answer to that question. And, you know, while AI might find a very, very easy home in kind of, you know, hyper-produced pop and sort of, you know, I'm thinking about kind of that amazing kind of hyper-real sort of, you know, K-pop. And, I mean, you know the kind of direction I'm talking about. Whereas I can't, there's so much stuff that's kind of like... that is so far in the other direction.
Well, I mean, it's always going to sort of lack humanity in a way, isn't it?
And that matters more in some areas than others. And,
yeah.
And to some audiences more than others. So
yeah.
There certainly won't be one answer to that, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
I think you're right.
Arturia has a wide selection of software effects, including 3 compressors, 3 filters, 3 preamps, and 3 delays you'll actually use. The latest release, 3 delays you'll actually use, includes Delay Tape 201, Delay Memory Brigade, and the unique and experimental Delay Eternity. A bundle of selected effects, called the AudioFuse Creative Suite, is included with all AudioFuse audio interfaces. Visit Arturia.com to find out more on the effects you'll actually use.
The thing about music, which I'm sort of latching on to myself, is that it is all opinion. So there isn't a right or a wrong way. There isn't a perfect song or an imperfect song, because you hear some songs that someone might hate and someone might love. So there isn't a formula as such. There's, you know, a certain amount of formula, but there's not. an exact science as to what a hit record is. And so I'm hoping, praying that AI don't...
Yeah, Tricky Stewart said, and this is like the coolest quote, I think. He's like, his like main production tip was like, always leave enough space for God to walk into the room. And I kind of feel that that's basically what... That's like the alchemy of music making. There's always that like tiny little, actually it's quite a large percentage, where it's just like there's some magic and no one really knows how to sprinkle it. Some people know how to sprinkle it a bit better than others, but you know, it's sometimes there are just those magic ones and no one really knows why.
Exactly. You don't want it to be formulaic, you know. I think it's important not to... I don't know how you sort of approach production, but I think some people have a more kind of formulaic approach where they envision exactly the sound, the genre, you know, everything that they're going to do beforehand. And whereas some people have a more kind of creative approach where they sort of just throw in ideas and that sort of thing.
I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive, because what I'd say is that is that you do, well, most people do want music to be formulaic or just formulaic enough, but to have those extra little points of difference that take it out of that. But otherwise, it's I think about kind of, you know, when you hear just a great song, and great songs usually are pretty simple and are usually pretty, you know, for want of a better word, formulaic.
Yeah.
But they're just different enough to keep your interest.
That's the thing. I think it's the not going overboard with the sort of formula.
There needs to be something in there as well as the formulaic thing, but it needs to reference it, because that's where genre comes from. That's where all these, you know, it's like building listener expectation. And the only reason that you know what to expect is because it's similar to something that you've heard many times before, but it can't be the same, because otherwise it becomes dull.
I think that's why I really like Ray's new music, because it just feels, you know, there's all the right kind of hooks and that sort of thing, but it kind of diverts slightly from the typical songwriting kind of things that you tend to hear. So
We definitely have a sort of saying, like, you know, we'll say in sessions, oh, that feels too songwritery, and I think what you're kind of saying is that feels too contrived, too thought about, not impulsive enough, not, do you know what I mean? There's
a word I use is arbitrary, of like, if you hear something that conforms to a recognized, you know, refers to music that's happened before, but it's like, okay, I've heard this bit, I know how the rest of the song's going to go.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you. But then, you know, as you said, Julian, I do think that there's a certain element of that is also desirable. You know, there's some part of, you know, having heard something before, so it sounds familiar, it feels familiar, but at the same time, you can't quite put your finger on it, I think I think that's a good thing. So you're dancing a very fine line. You know, you don't want to obviously be, you know, completely unoriginal. But I think when you know, if you look at like formulas kind of thing, if you look at the way the song's structured, that a pop song anyway, that hasn't really changed all that much. And when people do deviate too far from that, people go, oh, well, that's experimental, or that's prog, or, you know, it becomes a whole different thing. And yes, you can deviate from it, but it's not a pop song anymore.
We also heard from an A&R, a major label recently, that said they weren't going to cut any songs that weren't already an existing song, i.e. sample or interpolation. Because they said it's in certain worlds, i.e. sort of dance pop world, that's what's working at the moment.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's like the movie reboots, isn't it? You know, where it like, there's so many movies that are just like, they're old comic books, or they're like sequels, or and I think that that's an element of that is happening in modern music.
That's just like risk aversion, though, isn't it, ultimately?
Yeah.
It was like the David Guetta track, and sort of the rehashed old 90s, early 2000s kind of dance music. That's a lot of people are doing that at the moment. It's great. I think it's
huge,
fabulous,
especially in the UK. It's absolutely massive. We were looking at Spotify charts, UK charts of the day, and we were like, holy crap, there's so much of that. So you kind of like get drawn into it.
Yeah, completely. So if you could choose like a track that you've done that you're sort of really proud of, maybe a super high, or, you know, another track, and sort of delve into the production process, that would be really cool for everyone listening, I think.
Obvious one's probably Following the Sun, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
It's our tune. Mate, take it away.
The production process.
Don't be too honest. Okay.
It's the most basic thing. It started with a Telecaster plugged into an API 512 DI, and that was it. That's a guitar sound right there.
We heard
with at all, just DI'd electric guitar.
Years ago, we heard a podcast with a massive songwriter producer, and he said when he's after certain things, he's chasing other songs, which we took as kind of referencing. It's a nice way of saying, I won't say what I'm going to say. And we were chasing two particular songs when we started that. So I'll sort of, there you go. Sorry, man, I interrupted you.
Yeah. No, so. Which
songs, if you don't mind me asking?
We were chasing
Malibu by Miley Cyrus. I think it's important to be honest. This is like when you start a day's writing and you've been doing it for 15 years, you've got to narrow down your start points because you have an infinite, you know, there's an infinite number of possibilities of what you could do in any given day. And on that particular day, we were working with George's sister and a really great writer called Negin. They were like, oh, we'd love to do something that's a bit like, you know, Miley Cyrus Malibu. So you have a listen and you're kind of like, oh, yeah, that I love the way that feels like beachy and surfy. And, you know, and then you could just kind of have a listen. And then it's important once you've had a listen and kind of like soaked in the feeling from that song, then obviously not to, you know, copy it too hard, but you know we were like, oh, what about chords like these, and that was the DI'd guitar that goes into the thing. And then for as far as I can remember, I played the chords, George, you were on the phone, you then came in and sang the chorus, and the next thing I remember most about it was that we kind of had it very quickly, you know, within I'd say 45 minutes. And we spend a long time after that debating where the Following the Sun was too, what we call bait, you know, where is it too basic?
Too
is
obvious.
It too stupid? And do you know what I mean? So we spent a long time going, is it too obvious? Is that too, do you know what I mean?
So not, yeah, not did you try out other enough, kind not of clever courses, enough. Then?
We did. We tried other headlines, but then the irony is that I think one of the reasons that song's done so well is because it's called Following the Sun, and it's just so simple, stupid, relatable. You know, it's been Vodafone Sing, it's been all over TV, all over the world.
I mean, it's a massive hook, isn't it? That chorus.
I think had we called it something else, like there was, yeah, my sister's not here to defend herself, but she was against it because she was like, I think it's too obvious. And after way too much time debating it, we were like, we can't think of anything better.
Took longer than formulating the idea. Yeah.
So it was the lyrics rather than the top line that you mm-hmm. were debating.
Yeah, yeah. Melodically, it was like it was ticking all the boxes for us. I felt like it was, you know, it was a winner. But then, just in terms of the lyric, it's like how simple's too simple.
We wanted to keep the feel of the track super lo-fi. It was kind of, there was a couple of different versions where because we were trying to be sort of cool indie dance world at the time. We never really saw this as a pop record. So it had quite a long intro. It had a much longer build. And then the guys that we ended up doing the like label deal with shortened it because they were like, this is a big radio single, which we'd never have thought it was. And then we had like quite a lot of tape emulation.
And we had tape hiss on it. And they were like, can you get rid of the hiss, please? And we were like, that's the vibe.
Yeah, and the hiss got removed.
You want us to get rid of the vibe? What are you talking about?
Did it get completely removed? Because I'm trying to remember how...
There's still some. You know how these like plugins, like some of them, they've just like default got like quite a lot of noise on them.
Yeah.
And then if you can kind of go through and one by one mute them when they're not doing anything, and I think we did an element of that, but I think we also had, from memory, we had like an actual loop of cassette noise, which we were like, actually that's too much noise.
Okay.
The problem is after it's all mastered and everything the hiss came up, and it was quite loud, but that's kind of what we were going for at the time. And we've actually tried to emulate that sound. We've tried to chase ourselves so many times. There's still a bit of magic about that mix that we can't get it exact.
Yeah.
You know, we've tried and tried.
How funny. And so
Sorry, Isha. Just another thing that I remember about the production is there's a splice sample on there. Yeah, there's a little Juno synth patch that we
that was it. That was the vibe.
Yeah, we tweaked around in Melodyne, and once we got that in, so you won't be able to find the actual patch because it's quite heavily manipulated. But it had a really good feeling, and something about them, how we Melodyned it, made it feel even kind of like wobblier and weirder. And so that was that's when we started getting the real feels for it.
Nice.
So it's
nice.
Basically those two elements.
That exact
that kind
thing
of
in
brings
loads of
me
songs.
On to, I don't know whether to ask you about the vocal chain in this song first or about kind of sampling and whether you do tend to use a lot of samples or combine them, how that works. But maybe go for the vocal chain. How did you create that kind of...
The vocal effect was a pain in the ass because we decided we were going to record thousands of vocals for all of it. So my sister and Negan, who are Nika, wanted to be across most of the record, all of it. So it was a case of they all sang it multiple times, multiple octaves, lefts, rights. Talk about the tuning, mate. That was quite fun.
Oh, yeah. So we were going for the really... lo-fi untuned feel, and we kind of stacked it up so much that we found that the pitch envelope was way too much. So we ended up tuning, what we did was we would tune like the left hand channel really hard, then leave the right untuned, and then on the other stacks do the opposite. So there were, I think it from memory, there are like six stacks in the verse alone, just like of loads of different vocals. And then they're all sent, all of those are sent to a bus, and then there's loads of crunchy stuff on the bus basically to try and make it deliberately. It was like we were chasing that really kind of pokey, like almost nasally kind of sound for the verses that then's like washed out in reverb. I think there's a little bit of slap from Echo Boy on there. There's like the crunch is from it's from the SSL channel strip in UAD, and there's I think there's actually a preset on there called Crunch that we probably didn't play around with.
Okay, well that's handy.
And then, yeah, there's definitely some slap from Echo Boy. And then I think that sort of washy reverb, we were going for that Lana Del Rey kind of thing. So I think it's from memory, EMT 140, just from UAD. Then we got quite heavily into like EQing all the returns so that the returns were lo-fi as well. So like we were doing high pass, low pass on the returns, so that it do you know what I mean? There's not too much high end, and there's not too much low cluttering stuff up. It sort of all sits. It's kind of middly and
And obviously, did you mix this, Rick?
Yeah. So it was one of those where people loved the demo so much. Actually, it's another like aside. You know, I was talking earlier about you know, other singers having a go. So this song actually got pitched to a big European artist and she sang it, and the label didn't like how she sounded on it. So it was one of those where it wasn't even really supposed to be a record for us. It was a record that we were actively pitching.
We did it with all the super high tracks that we've put out. We've always pitched them first, because we're not sort of arrogant enough to think that our artist project is the most important thing in the world, you know. And so everything we do gets sent out, and if we can't find the right home for it, in the back of our minds we think, well, we could always do that. So, and we've done that with a few songs.
Nice. And I bet you're glad you did, to be honest.
Yeah, that one in particular was that kind of opened up a whole new avenue of creativity that we didn't even know existed, and it's taken us on just the maddest journey. So that's been amazing.
Yeah. So are you going to be touring or doing anything, or are you just going to carry on sort of writing?
TBC. I think we need a few more hits under our belt. You know, we've put out a load of songs. I don't think we have a fan base. So that's the first issue. Someone did DM us recently and saying, if you come to Nottingham, there will be five people for sure.
So, really?
Five. Yeah. Yeah,
but there's a
that.
Serious point in there. There definitely is in this day and age, people are into songs, not artists.
Yeah.
You know, there I think there are like you know, I think there are certain artists, obviously, that people, you know, really into that artist, and so they you know, lap everything up that, that comes out. But I see it with my own kids. They're much more just, oh, I really like that particular song. They don't really know very much about who did it. And that's kind of, I suppose, how it should be. Because there's no way that we're really like an artist proposition. We got lucky with a song, and it's cool.
The Production Expert Podcast is made possible using Source Connect Now from Source Elements, the free way to record high-quality audio over the internet. Need to record an interview or a podcast like this one remotely? With Source Connect Now, you can. Using a Chrome browser, you'll get ISDN-equivalent quality audio without the need to install any additional software. Register for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
So how did you get so lucky, to be honest? Is there
great
sort of
team.
Great team?
I mean, the Blended guys that were the label that we went with eventually. We had a couple of other majors sort of talk at the table talking about putting this out. And Al Weber and his brother Billy, who were sort of ex-label guys that were forming this like indie label collective thing that was made up of four managers in four different territories. This was the first thing they'd ever done, and they were just so hyped on the song, and they were just so the same. They were same as us. They were like, look, we're going to do this, and we just thought, sort of, you know, this is what we've had so many punts in the world. This is definitely worth it. And they were so dynamic and aggressive in forcing this song to be a hit. You know, they were going around DSPs. They were Bjorn, who's the guy, and he's like our German arm of Blended. He got us that Vodafone campaign, which meant we were the Vodafone Hold music in Germany for about 6 months.
People nice. Must hate it there.
6 months, that was a long time to be on hold.
If you look at what to say about Vodafone, but that bred us the radio. You know, we were quite a big radio song in Germany, which then went on to Australia. It all happened at different times because it's such a summer record, and it's sort of the seasons are different, obviously. So it was winter here and it was all calming down, and then Australia was kicking off, and we were the number 9th played song in the whole of Australian radio. And I think our manager always says Bieber was number 10. So it shows you the sort of level we were competing with. And it's still going now, you know. It's one of our highest streaming songs. It's even like to this day, you know, it's been out 3 years. But I think a lot of it is down to the team. They were so on it.
Team were great, but also I do think there was an element of like luck about it, in the sense that, you know, we were in COVID, and it's a song about being free and carefree and being able to go wherever you want to go. And I think it kind of just like intersected quite nicely with like what people were feeling at that time. You know, it just kind of tapped into a feeling, and I think that is definitely an element of it. I doubt whether it would have the same reception if we put it out now.
Well, you're being very modest. So.
Well, no, I'm actually just trying to be honest. I really do think that you can't, even with the best team in the world, you can't force a song to be a hit. And there's a certain amount of like luck in there, magic, whatever you want to call it. You can't, you know, we've done this for an awfully long time. And if I could make every song a hit, I would, but I can't. We can't.
You
it's
can't
just,
make something
it's not
a hit.
Possible. Yeah. Exactly. You can try, and you can use your experience to get it close. But, you know, all the songs that you think are going to be never are. And the ones you never expect, you know, have a chance. It's a funny old business.
It really is. It's something we never really touch on because it's a bit vulgar, but there was a lot of investment. So initially there was a small investment, and we just said, look, if this song connects, just put everything back into it. Let's just see what we can do. And, you know, we've never actually seen any money from the song, from the master yet, because we've just continually done that to this day. So it's just been about continuous investment.
I think for us, it was a real eye opener about the business side of things, in a sense that I had never really experienced before, because we'd always handed over our masters to, you know, labels basically, and then once you've done that deal, it's out of your hands and you just kind of watch it and see what it does. And because we were much more involved in this one, we got to see a different, and also kind of it opened our eyes to if things like remixes. Like, I would always be like, oh, why does everybody do so many remixes? They're completely pointless and yada, yada, yada. But in actual fact, the remixes really drove the record, and they drive traffic. They open up audiences that you don't realize you know are going to get to the song. They push the numbers up on Spotify overall. You know, there was so much clever stuff that with the business side of things that I had just not really understood before this process. So it was cool working with, there's a guy called Eric Fritchie who's like the head kind of strategy guy, and the way he was saying, right, we need to push into Australia now. And, you know, I was kind of like, the song is dead. And he was like, no, we go now. And we're going to spend this much money marketing it and all this kind of stuff. And we were just like, okay. And sure enough, the business guys that we were working with really knew their stuff. So I think, you know, we have to give them so much credit. But it was a really interesting, I've been much less kind of cynical about the business side of things since I have been an insider in, you know, or had the inside view on this record. I think there's so much more to marketing a track and pushing it through than creators ever really realize.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what kind of remixes did you have then? Did you have like a deep house kind of remix?
So many. We had about 10 remixes. House, we had drum and bass, we had I don't even know what you'd call it, but it sounded like something you would listen to if you were on ketamine.
Seriously dark, yeah.
But there was, I was just about to say that, because there was one point where we never really considered it a success in the UK, because it was much bigger song globally. But there was a point where we were Capital Dance's record of the week with a Diego Drut remix. The main version, or it might have even been the same version, was Radio 1's record of the week, and we were B-list Radio 2 with the normal version. So those remixes enabled us to sort of span different genres almost, right, with the same song.
And yeah. I'm more than happy to put my hand up and go on record that I was so sniffy about remixes prior to this. I was kind of like, they're the most pointless thing ever.
And the real irony is we now do lots of them.
Really?
Yeah, it's true. As super, we've been asked to do those remixes. Same for the, you know, same.
Yeah, we love it.
Same reason.
And people use our remixes, and we see them streaming really well, because again, they hit. You can take a song that's a certain genre, and you can turn it into a sort of more commercial, more pop genre, which is what we kind of do, and then it enables that song to have a second life.
Okay, brilliant. So that's all, you know, really interesting. So let's just talk about your kind of favourite studio gear and why that is. And I mean, you have an amazing studio, so yeah.
Can I be really boring and pick the API 512C preamp?
That's not boring. That's
I think
fine.
That pre's are like the unsung hero of studio gear. No one really, you know, people are kind of get really excited about compressors and other, you know, more exciting boxes. But I think that a lot of the sound of, you know, a great record comes from the preamps. Good pre going in, you know, it turns a rubbish mic into a good sounding thing. I think they're awesome. I love those. They're my favorite bits.
Why did you go API? They're not necessarily the biggest, the most natural choice here in the UK.
I've had them ever since I first made enough money to buy a decent bit of gear, and I just loved the sound. As soon as I heard them, I plugged a SM57 into it, and I was like, is this the same mic? I've just loved the sound of them ever since. You can push them really hard, and you get this kind of saturation that's not unpleasant. They're just awesome bits of gear, and the DI sounds great as well. So yeah,
so that's your go-to
big fan of them.
Kind of preamp.
Definitely for guitars, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Totally concur on that one. I mean, the DI is an interesting one as well, because it sounds like you're not averse to a DI'd guitar now and again, which
has
a fine history in recorded music.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's like whatever works. I think sometimes, you know, you can overthink things too. I used to, because I came from a sort of band background, I used to be very kind of purist about it. And I was like, oh, you got to amp it up. But
it's very final.
Nile Rodgers. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. But after you've made a few records, it's you're kind of like, oh, I wish I hadn't like done that much distortion, or I wish I had cleaned that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and you're kind of like, I'd like having the flexibility.
I'm pretty sure
Nile change things.
Nile sent us both as well. I'm pretty sure when we worked with him, he sent us a DI and a
Yeah, oh, definitely. And also, he was the first one to say, don't be precious about keeping all of it. Just if you find a good loop, use the loop. I try not to be too purist about things. I always say, yeah, definitely.
Good call.
When did you work with Nile Rodgers, quickly?
We worked with him and Tom Grennan
on Zoom
2 years ago. Yeah,
bonkers session.
Nice.
But he was like one of the coolest guys. We started our session. This is on Zoom, talking about Trump and American politics. And he's very erudite and well informed. And he's just awesome just to hear him talk about everything. And just a legend.
Fantastic. Cool. So George, what is your favorite?
I'm going to have to choose something that we don't have and I really want, which is that Sony, C800 microphone.
C8000.
I love it. And we still haven't bitten the bullet and bought one, but we should. The problem is it works so well on 90% of voices, but that 10%.
Are you talking about C800G?
Yes, that's the one.
I can talk to this of just, get yourself a Townsend Sphere. Because I did a lot of work with Chris when Townsend was still owned by Townsend, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And it's in Chris Townsend's opinion the most accurate model that they've done. There's a piece on the blog about it actually, but they're not cheap microphones, the Sony.
No.
But if you haven't already tried one, try the model because from someone who knows, he's particularly proud of that one. Put it that way.
That's good. Yeah. We hire them in quite often, the Sony.
Well, get hold of a Sphere when you've got one hired in and see if you still want to buy the Sony.
That's actually really good. Yeah. That's a really good piece of consumer advice.
Yeah, look it up on the blog. There's a whole piece that I did about that and a little while ago now, but
Did you put them next to each other?
No, I didn't have the mic. This was based on a load of measurements that have been done elsewhere. But I spoke to Chris quite a bit about it at the time, and he's not ashamed of any of the models, but that's the one that he was saying, this one's really good. So
amazing, that's good. Yeah, because we need such a we need a new mic. So
you get more than one if you get one of those. They're ever so good. Excellent. I think it's time we went to Find of the Week. We've gone pretty long, so Find of the Week.
RSPE Audio Solutions design, sell, and install professional audio and video equipment. Their team are available by phone, live chat, or email to receive and process orders. They have everything you need to build or upgrade your home studio to ensure you can continue to work from home. If there is anything they can do to help, reach out or shop online at rspeaudio.com.
Julian, why don't you go with your
Well, mine's a bit of a find that I found at the bottom of a box of things. I thought this had gone years and years ago, but it's a songbook, you know, the kind of like piano, guitar, vocal type thing. Songs of David Bowie, first published 1973. Very, very. I think the print I've got is from 1977. Somehow, I stole this off my then girlfriend in probably 1988 or something. And and I found it at the bottom of a box. And fantastic thing to find, just because I'd forgotten all about it. And it's been a bit of a journey of just kind of like. That classic Bowie stuff, especially like the hunky dory stuff with Rick Wakeman on piano and everything. That's if you can say, you can get chord sheets online. Yeah, you can get them. They've been worked out by people who think that anything that sounds slightly dissonant is a diminished. It rarely is. This has got the actual chords in it. and I've been working through, stuff, Life on Mars and stuff, and Changes Pretty Things. Yeah, Bewley Brothers, all those kinds of things, and it's just been great to really kind of get. Because at the time I looked at it, and I went, "Oh, this is full of complicated chords. I don't know what they are." These days, I'm going, "Yeah, I see how that works. Yeah, that's a minor 251, and this is a absolutely loving it."
Yeah, cool, fantastic. What about you, George?
I've had a whole hour to think about it, and actually, I've just changed it once more after you said that. So someone sent us a find, which this week someone sent us some music that their 8-year-old had been sent home with to play on the piano, and it was one of our songs. And I was holy shit, that's really cool. And it was the sheet music for a song called Could Have Been Me, which we wrote 12 Aww. Years ago. And that is very narcissistic, but I'm going with it.
No. That's brilliant. Fantastic. What about you, Rick?
Can I be really naughty and have like two? I'll be really quick. So the audio one, I'm probably super late to the party here, but is Transcape by Kilohertz. That's a cool little plugin. And I've been enjoying playing with that. And then I also saw on Instagram, because I get targeted with these things, an underwater jetpack, which, you strap on this kind of like backpack and it's got basically a jet ski engine in it.
Oh my goodness.
And it enables you to become a human dolphin and you like whiz around and you've got this sort of like throttle in one hand. And I was just like, that looks like the coolest thing ever.
See,
but also looks like an accident waiting to happen as well.
Yeah,
but it did look cool.
Shay, what's yours?
Oh yeah, mine's very boring, but it's useful. It's Sonobol's AI kind of smart gate, which is basically, instead of being, you know, triggered by the overall input signal, it basically takes something like a vocal and it just concentrates on that. So it's triggered. It's not triggered by background noises, for example.
It knows. That's what you're saying.
It knows, exactly.
I'm a huge fan of the Oxford, Sonox Oxford's Oxford drum gate. And it sounds to me like this is kind of, that's a few years old now. So nobody else has been there. So I watched that one with interest.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Awesome. Oxford Drumgate is amazing. That's all we've got time for this week. So thank you to Shay, thank you to Rick and George. Thank you very much for being on.
Thanks for having us.
Really interesting chat. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Production Expert Podcast.